Help DEA keep our communities safe and healthy by participating in National Prescription Drug Takeback Day, Saturday, October 25th. Take action right in your own home by cleaning out your medicine cabinet of unneeded medications. Keep them safe, clean them out, take them back. Find a collection site near you at DEATakeback.com. Do your part to lower overdose deaths and prevent prescription drug misuse before it starts. That's DEATakeback.com.
From the unexplained to the mundane, come join us on a journey to the fringe.
Hello and welcome to Journey to the Fringe, where, Chelsea, I think it's a fairly reasonable thing to say that we've both had issues with authority, both in the past, not run-ins with them, just problems with authority. It's a personality trait that I think we both have. What with you not being able to take tests well because somebody's judging you, and I just having been sold that the police are out to get me since I was like 3 years old, just not trusting anything with an authority figure.
I thought you were talking about all the arrests.
Yeah, I know. I had to specify that. Anyhow, we are your podcast hosts, Taylor and Chelsea, here today, kind of giving you an idea, a sense of mass wrongdoings that the police have done in the past. And I police might be the wrong word for it, because we're going to talk about sheriff's departments as well. But this is kind of a response. If somebody says, which I hate this response, when you're talking about them with specific cases of malpractice by police officers, and they say, well, that's just one bad apple. Which, if you look at that entire phrase, one bad apple ruins the batch, in fact, means that is an entirely terrible thing to have the one bad apple there. But hey, these are going to be examples of, no, there's entirely huge problems with the police that need to be addressed. Although we're only talking about specific cities' issues, this is a systemic issue all throughout the first world, I guess would be a proper way to say it, or at least North America, that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, you wouldn't think it would just be exclusive to certain cities.
So Chelsea, strap yourself in. We've got three cases here to look at. Just to give you a warning, they're going to get worse as we go.
Okay, so you went least worst to worst.
Yeah, at least worst to worst. Yeah, and it was a tough choice to make the worst one, but they're all pretty bad in their own right. So Chelsea, I hope you're ready for this. Did you know that if you're rich enough, you can just hire an entire police precinct?
Do what? What would I be searching for them for? Body double.
We're not just talking about, like, if you're pulled over by the cops, slipping them a 20 and going on your way. No, we're talking an entire state's police being paid off to do particular things for a group.
Like, what would I want them to do that for? Oh, if you didn't want them to know what's happening.
No, not necessarily that, but you're kind of on the right track here. Now, this story, Vice News did a great job on this happening. This happened in 2021. It's from Motherboard, which is a subsidiary of Vice. And it's specifically about a pipeline that was being built from Canada to the U.S. A Canadian oil company gave Minnesota law enforcement $2 million to fund the policing of protests against construction of its pipeline. Calgary-based oil giant Enbridge set up a fund called the Public Safety Escrow Trust in May of 2020 as part of its permitting process for the Line 3 pipeline route, which carries oil from Edmonton, Alberta, to Superior, Wisconsin, which is not Superior to Edmonton, I don't think. It's just the name of the city that it's going to.
Nice tactic.
Yeah. The funds in this account have been used to reimburse costs associated with maintaining the peace around the pipeline, including for officers' wages, lodging, and boom trucks, according to the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission and Line 3 permits. On July 29th, 2021, a group of unarmed environmental activists protesting the pipeline in Thief River Falls, Minnesota, were tear gassed, shot with rubber bullets, and arrested. Quote, "It was a really brutal scene. The level of force being used partnered with the very close range that law enforcement was facing us led to some pretty serious injuries. It was really an extreme level of force partnered with a really punitive and oppressive style of jailing," said Tara Houska, an Ojibwe lawyer and activist who was arrested at the protests. The nearby Marshall County Sheriff's Department filed a reimbursement request for expenses associated with that day's patrol. A spokesperson for the Minnesota PUC, which we talked about earlier, confirmed to Motherboard. According to the utility regulator, between June 8th and July 31st, that Sheriff's Department was reimbursed $20,057.90 by Enbridge for personnel expenses associated with Line 3 assists. And the Marshall County Sheriff's Department did not respond to a request for comment. Enbridge justifies the pipeline expansion as necessary to uphold high safety standards. But community members living near it say the project exchanges environmental destruction and sacrifices land for a polluting energy source. The pipeline has also been tied to several instances of sex trafficking, harassment, and assault. That's a whole other article that we're not going to get into because this is going to be a long episode in itself, of local community members. Environmental activists, many from indigenous territories through which the pipeline would run, have opposed the project for the last 7 years. Activists' efforts ramped up in November 2020 when Minnesota's Pollution Control Agency, MPCA, issued Enbridge water crossing permits. Grassroots collectives like Honor the Earth, Minnesota 350, and Stop Line 3 have garnered international support, including from the likes of Jane Fonda, for direct actions held to obstruct the HALT pipeline construction in the months since. Many of these direct actions have been met with violence by local police. Though the July 29th incident was not the first time activists have been met by resistance from law enforcement, it was the first time police had used less than lethal weapons. The Ginyu Collective, an environmental activist group led by Indigenous women and Two-Spirits people organizing against the pipeline, wrote in a Facebook post on August 1st of 2021. 20 activists were arrested and taken to Pennington County Jail, where several were denied food and medical care for their injuries and held in solitary confinement, the group claimed. Among them was Ginyu Collective founder Huska, who stated, after being attacked and zip-tied, she was kept in solitary confinement for days, denied food that aligned with her dietary needs, and ultimately hospitalized. Pennington County Jail Administrator Dave Casanova, the existence of the Public Safety Escrow Fund has been known for some time, thanks to activists and media reports. An April report from the Minnesota Reformer, based on documents obtained through public record requests, showed that Enbridge established a financial relationship with Minnesota law enforcement in May of 2020 as part of the permits that PUC issued, creating, quote, a public safety, end quote, reimbursement fund for any pipeline-related police action and emergency responders.
That's fucked up.
In its permitting documentation, the PUC cited increased law enforcement expenses around pipelines in other parts of the country as reasoning for establishing the fund. The funds live in an escrow account managed by a state-appointed official to whom agencies send requests for reimbursements of costs related to, quote, coordination of public safety and emergency responders, public safety-related costs for maintaining the peace in and around the construction site, review and oversight of any private security services, end quote, and other similar costs.
It's not public safety if the oil company is paying them. Jesus Christ.
The financial arrangement allows the state's police departments to get reimbursed by the fossil fuel corporations for, quote, maintaining the peace in and around the pipeline construction site and coordinating services, Atkin reported. That included those undertaken by a task force of 18 sheriff's departments, the Northern Lights Task Force, which was created to deter pipeline protests. In April of 2021, Enbridge had paid law enforcement over $500,000 out of this fund. We have also learned that figures have ballooned far from there. Per a spokesperson of the MPUC, the oil giant has paid $1,957,011.37 in law enforcement expenses to date.
That's a hard number.
That is a really hard number. That's too many numbers. Just round it, please. Yes.
How many cents?
Why are they paying cents? Round up, please.
For the sake of those seeing the number, at least. Have some compassion.
These expenses likely helped cover what Huska says has been relentless surveillance by Minnesota police along the pipeline's route for the last year. Quote, there's a law enforcement officer parked right across the dirt road that we live on right now. Like, that's the daily occurrence there, 24 hours a day. End quote, says Huska. Huska says the financial relationship between Enbridge and the state regulator is an indication of its undue influence. She recalled receiving flippant comments from arresting officers as she and fellow protesters were detained, alluding to the partnership. Quote, the police who are standing around as we're wearing zip ties are talking about how much fun they had, and they hoped we came back real soon, and that they're going to get time and a half. We're sitting there, hurt, and unable to open our eyes because we've had so much mace in them, and they're just laughing at us, end quote, Huska says. Since the creation in 2020, $327,000 of the Enbridge Fund has gone to the Cass County Sheriff's Office, located 180 miles north of Minneapolis, for security patrols of pipeline property, the reformer noted. This amounted to around 7% of the department's salary and overtime budget for that year. Between November 28, 2020 and February 19, 2021, over 40 employees dedicated more than 7,000 hours to safety patrol. and another $171,000 went to Beltrami County Sheriff's Department for officers training as early as 2017. Preparation for the pipeline and mileage for response to Line 3 protests. All of this was paid for by Enbridge. Enbridge spokesperson Julie Kellner said that the company recognizes protesters' rights to, quote, express their views about the energy we all use, but it does not tolerate illegal and unsafe acts. That's the end of the quote. That's the end of the article. And that's how easy it is to just buy a police department.
I feel like Enbridge doesn't make the law to say what they can support and not, and the police don't need to be paid to uphold peace.
Especially when that's what we're doing. We're supposed to be doing that. That's the whole point of taxes.
Yeah, we already pay you to not get paid by somebody else so that you could protect them, the billionaire. So, I mean, I laugh, but it's disgusting.
That's the first one. You can just buy a police department if you really need to. You got enough money.
Well, now that I know that, maybe when I need them, I'll buy them.
Okay. And if you guys want to give us enough money to actually buy a police department, please do so. So far, you have given us zero monies to buy a police department. So any effort will help.
They haven't paid us money to do shit with. I'm sorry. It's true.
No judgment here. Don't worry, guys. Next up, did you know that departments can be full of gangs?
What kind of departments?
In this case, it's a sheriff's department, but I'm going to boldly go out there and say it's probably not the only one. It likely could also extend out to police departments.
Okay, law enforcement. What's the difference between a sheriff and a law enforcement? You keep saying them as if they're
I was really trying to figure this out. Basically, sheriffs are generally an elected position. I don't know the case here. We're talking about the LA Sheriff's Department, which is the largest sheriff's department in the US. Generally, sheriffs will be elected, but I don't know the case specifically with the LA Sheriff Department. And there is also the LAPD, and I don't know the specific separation here. Generally, sheriffs will also provide, I shouldn't say policing, but policing to courthouses and prisons.
Okay.
As well as they'll take care of the more state-oriented laws.
Okay, that's good enough for me.
That's simple enough to explain it. There's way more to it than that, but I think that's enough to at least get us going from here. And
you said they're run by gangs?
No, they're full of gangs.
They are a part of the gangs.
Let's read this story and you're going to learn as we go, because this is this was absolutely ridiculous when I learned this, and it's a fairly recent revelation. Okay. So LASD, Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, has over 18,000 employees, and that makes the LA County Sheriff's Department the largest in the US. But it is plagued by dozens of often violent gangs and cliques organized by sheriff's deputies. This has been going on since at least 1973.
What? Like, are we talking about, like, Crips and Bloods?
No.
That's the only gangs I know in the area.
It's entirely unique to the sheriff's department, and you're going to learn about it here. It's just ridiculous. We're going to be pulling from two sources. One is the Civilian Oversight Commission on Sheriff's Department in LA.
That's spooky.
This is a document that was drafted and came out as of February of 2023. As well as there is a pretty good NPR article on this. So we're going to be pulling from both of these. To start off from the COC, the Civilian Oversight Commission, we're going to start with this. Deputy gangs and deputy cliques have existed in the LA County Sheriff's Department since at least 1973. That year, an internal department memo dated December 5th documented the existence of a group known as the Little Devils and identified 38 members who bore sequential numbered tattoos of a devil.
What? In the Sheriff's Department?
In the Sheriff's Department, yes. In 1992, the Colts Commission report confirmed the existence of deputy gangs and deputy cliques, including deputy gangs called the Vikings, in the department. After holding evidentiary hearings in Los Angeles in 93 and 96, the United States Commission on Civil Rights in 1999 issued a report focusing on the violence and trauma the deputy gangs had inflicted on communities of color and people struggling with mental illness, and urged the LASD to take decisive action to eradicate the deputy gangs from its ranks. In 2012, the Citizens Commission on Jail Violence, CCJV, found that the deputy cliques existed in patrol and on certain floors of men's central jails, MCJs, if that comes up again, and that they contributed to the use of excessive force in the jails. The CCJV's report contains 5 pages of recommendations to address the problem. The Loyola Law School report documented the department's long history of 8 deputy gangs and deputy cliques in 2021, and the RAND Corporation also confirmed the existence in its report titled Understanding Subgroups Within the LA County Sheriff's Department in 2021. All the deputy cliques share harmful characteristics. While not all deputy cliques engage in identical unprofessional conduct. Most share at least some of the following characteristics, and they have done and continue to do certain acts of unprofessional and dangerous policing. Deputy cliques run the stations or units where they exist, as opposed to the sergeants, lieutenants, and the captains who are charged with the duty to run the station. Exercise influence over and often decide assignments and shifts, training and overtime. Exclude deputies from the deputy cliques, often based on race, ethnicity, and gender. Intimidate deputies that are not part of the deputy cliques. Give orders not to provide backup to disfavored deputies who are not members of the deputy cliques. Order work slowdowns if management of a station attempts to rein them in. Encourage a we they attitude, as in a separate we are the gang and there's everybody else who's against us. And not just between them and the public, but with other deputies within the station. Operate in secrecy. Lie in reports to protect each other and threaten the public with use of excessive force without justification and belittle deputies unwilling to engage in such acts. Most troubling, they create rituals that valorize violence, such as recording all deputy-involved shootings in official books, celebrating with shooting parties, and authorizing deputies who have shot a community member to add embellishments to their common gang tattoos.
I'm just lost for words.
This is literally from a civilian oversight commission. Like, this is documents that they collected on it, and we're going to talk about people who actually talked to them about this as we get going.
This is insane. How does this even happen? Is this just an LA thing?
That's a great question. We're going to keep going. Typically, to be invited to become a member of a deputy gang or deputy clique, a deputy must demonstrate, quote, toughness, end quote, that is frequently associated with the use of excessive force or other forms of unconstitutional policing. Often the euphemistic term peer leader is used to describe the members. Deputy gangs and deputy cliques also have used and continue to use assaultive behavior against fellow deputies who do not belong to their group as a show of power and influence. Certain of these altercations have led to public exposure in the media. The COC investigation uncovered these other incidents, including threatened use of weapons by deputies upon other deputies. The pernicious effects of these groups go well beyond assaulting other deputies. Recent publicly released body cam footage of a deputy threatening to shoot a man in a parked car without any evidence of wrongdoing illustrated in real time gang behavior characteristics of deputy gangs and deputy cliques interacting with the public served. Not all members of deputy cliques engage in acts of misconduct. Even those members who do not engage in misconduct, however, contribute to the unprofessional influence of deputy cliques and their negative impact on the department and on other deputies. Deputy cliques have and continue to do great damage to the reputation of the department, and the public hearings demonstrated that they have unquestionably destroyed trust between the department and the public it serves.
This is insane.
And Chelsea, this is just giving you an example. This is just one group. Members of the Jump Out Boys shared a common number tattoo that depicts a red-eyed skull wearing a bandana with the letter OSS and holding a revolver next to an ace of spades and an eight of spades, the so-called dead man's hand in poker. Their creed recited that members understand, quote, when the line need to be crossed and crossed back, end quote, and that they, quote, sometimes need to do things that they do not want to in order to get where they want to be, end quote. It also directed members to keep a, quote, black book, end quote, that records the dates of every deputy involved shooting, that records the date of every deputy involved shooting, that authorized each shooter to embellish his common tattoo with smoke coming out of the gun. 7 Jump Out Boys members were fired, but because there was no clear policy against joining a deputy gang at the time, the Civil Service Commission reinstated 4 of them.
What? Is there a law against it now?
That was one of the recommendations, I believe. That wasn't really what I was looking at this point. And like, there's so much we have to go into still with even this that it's hard to catch it all. And then there's another story after this one, which I think is worse.
Okay.
It is indisputable that for nearly 50 years, deputy gangs and deputy cliques have existed within the department, and their existence and negative impacts were known to the leadership of the department. Yet there was no sustained effort during this period to eradicate deputy gangs and deputy cliques from the department. All prior efforts were inadequate, lost continuity, and failed to eliminate deputy gangs and deputy cliques. Owing to this failure, deputy gangs and deputy cliques are embedded in the culture of the department, either tolerated or ignored. Indeed, during the tenure of Sheriff Baca, the undersheriff, Paul Tanaka, was a tattooed member of the Vikings. According to the numerous witness interviews, former Sheriff Villanueva's undersheriff, Tim Mirakami, has a caveman tattoo, another gang. This is from the commission. I have another thing that will change this number, but there's at least a half dozen and possibly more deputy gangs and deputy cliques currently in the department, primarily at patrol stations, and they include the Executioners, the Bandidos, the Regulators, the Spartans, the Gladiators, the Cowboys, and the Reapers.
I don't even know what to... Okay.
And now we're going to move to a bit from the NPR article on this. Two recent undersheriffs, the second-in-command posts for the department, were identified by the commission as having gang tattoos. Paul Tanaka, the undersheriff from 2011-2013, and Tim Murakami, the undersheriff reporting to Alex Villanueva, until 2022, who we're just talking about. An extensive investigation by nonprofit newsroom Knock LA, which if you're looking for good information on this, go read Knock LA. That is the best location for this. Alleged dozens of gangs were associated with the sheriff's office, but also noted the county's district attorney routinely denies to charge members. The newsroom also reported the department tends to settle excessive force cases and other lawsuits involving alleged members before they go to trial, costing taxpayers millions. In the years since the Oversight Commission conducted an exhaustive review of its own, culminating in the report published in March, the new report found evidence of gang control of at least six sheriff's department stations: Compton Station, East LA, Station Lenox, Century Station, Lancaster, and Palmdale Station, as well as within Arrowboro, the department's helicopter division. The gangs are well documented for using excessive force on civilians, harassing other deputies, and using violence on inmates inside jails. The deputy gangs have historically proved a threat to the chain of command, according to multiple reports. According to the 1992 report, deputies at the then notorious Linwood Station, quote, harass and intimidate any sergeant or lieutenant who stood in their way, end quote. The report went on to say deputies would, quote, command field sergeants to leave the scene of arrest, to slash the tires of supervisors they did not like, to disregard orders not to roam freely outside their patrol areas in the city of LA, and to smear excrement and other noxious substances over the engines of their supervisors' cars. The intimidation tactics have continued to this day. In 2018, alleged members of the Bandidos deputy gang brutally attacked non-gang deputies in the East LA station. The beating hospitalized two LASD deputies who are now involved in years-long litigation against the department for harassment and discrimination. And Chelsea, just to give you an idea, this comes right from Knock LA. There are at least 24 gangs within the LA County Sheriff's Department. Officials at various government agencies, including the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors, the Los Angeles County District Attorney, the California Senate Subcommittee on Police Officers' Conduct, and the United States Commission on Civil Rights have heard testimonies on the violence inflicted on communities at the hands of deputy gangs for decades. Deputy gangs have killed at least 40 people, all of whom were men of color. At least 10 of them had mental illnesses. LA County keeps a list of lawsuits related to the deputy gangs. Litigation related to these cases has cost the county at least $100 million over 30 years.
How come we don't really hear anything about this for it, like, running rampant?
Well, part of it is it's really hard to report on police departments and sheriff's departments because they have good protection within and they don't really have any oversight. And one thing that comes with this is they are absolutely ruthless with targeting people who try to kind of bring them out. Anybody who talked to the commission I was talking about, the COC, There was one woman, I didn't write her name down. She was in the sheriff's department. As soon as she started talking to him, she was demoted. Immediately demoted and put on graveyard shifts.
Okay.
She also said that people were tailing her 24/7.
Oh my God.
Other people who were talked to the commission said that they had warrants for the search of their properties issued multiple times throughout the investigation that they were involved in.
I guess they are a gang. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Disturbing.
That is absolutely fucked up. Just something you would not expect to hear. Even no. Then, like when you hear that, you don't quite understand what it means because you're like, yeah, the Bloods are the Crips. No, their own unique gangs within the department.
In addition to the Bloods and the Crips, operating not in the police department. They didn't have the proper law structure like the police department has with the gang. But that is messed up. I can't believe this.
For the last one here, apparently police departments can sometimes have black sites where they torture people. This comes from the Chicago Police Department, and we're just going to read this story. There's many different stories on it. There's a Wikipedia article. I decided to go with the Guardian article on it. It seems like it was fairly well covered in it. We're just going to go through this, and this is rough.
Okay, shit.
The Chicago Police Department operates an off-the-books interrogation compound, rendering Americans unable to be found by family or attorneys while locked inside what lawyers say is the domestic equivalent of a CIA black site.
Oh, God.
The facility, a nondescript warehouse in Chicago's west side known as Holman Square, has long been the scene of secretive work by special units. Alleged police practices at Homan Square, according to those familiar with the facility, who spoke out to The Guardian after its investigation into Chicago police abuse, include, this is what happens here. Keeping arrests out of official booking databases, beatings by police resulting in head wounds, shackling for prolonged periods, denying attorneys access to the secure facility, holding people without legal counsel for between 12 and 24 hours, including people as young as 15. At least one man was found unresponsive in Homan Square's interview room and later pronounced dead. Brian Jacob Church, a protester known as one of the NATO Three, and this is actually where it comes from, Chelsea, where we actually learned about Homan Square being a thing. There was a NATO summit in 2012 in Chicago. Chicago police said that they didn't arrest anybody, but there were three people missing. And that's basically where journalists started to dig, and they discovered this. This is where it came out. It had been going on a lot longer than 2012 and only 2012. Officers restrained Church for the better part of a day, denying him access to an attorney before sending him to a nearby police station to be booked and charged. Quote, Homan Square is definitely an unusual place. It brings to mind the interrogation facilities they use in the Middle East. The CIA calls them black sites. It's a domestic black site. When you go in, no one knows what happened to you. End quote, Church told The Guardian. The secretive warehouse is the latest example of Chicago police practices that echo the much criticized detention abuses of the US War on Terror. While those abuses impacted people overseas, Homan Square, said to house military-style vehicles, interrogation cells, and even a cage, trains its focus on Americans, most often poor, black, and brown. Unlike a precinct, no one taken to Homan Square is said to be booked. Witnesses, suspects, or other Chicagoans who end up inside do not appear to have a public searchable record entered into a database indicating where they are, as happens when somebody's booked at a precinct. Lawyers and relatives insist there's no way of finding their whereabouts. Those lawyers who have attempted to gain access to Homan Square are often turned away, even as their clients remain in custody inside. Quote, it's sort of an open secret among attorneys that regularly make police station visits this place. If you can't find a client in the system, odds are they're here, end quote, said Chicago lawyer Julia Bartmus. Chicago civil rights attorney Flint Taylor said Homan Square represented a routinization of a notorious practice in local police work that violates the Fifth and Sixth Amendment of the Constitution. Quote, this Homan Square revelation seems to me to be an institutionalization of the practices that date back more than 40 years of violating a suspects or witnesses' rights to a lawyer and not to be physically or otherwise coerced into giving a statement, end quote, said Taylor. Much remained hidden about Homan Square. The Chicago Police Department did not respond to The Guardian's questions about the facility, but after The Guardian published the story, the department provided a statement insisting, without specifics, that there's nothing untoward taking place at what is called the, quote, sensitive, end quote, location home to undercover units. This is their statement, quote, CPD abides by all laws, rules, and guidelines pertaining to any interviews of suspects or witnesses at Homan Square or any other CPD facility. If lawyers have a client detained at Homan Square, just like any other facility, they are allowed to speak to and visit them. It also has the CPD's evidence recovered property section, where the public is able to claim inventory property. End quote, the statement said. Something numerous attorneys and one Homan Square arrestee have denied. And a little bit more from it, quote, there are always records of anyone who was arrested by CPD, and this is not any different at Homan Square, end quote, it continued. The Chicago Police Department statement did not address how long into an arrest or detention those records are generated or their availability to the public. A department spokesperson did not respond to a detailed request for clarification. When a Guardian reporter arrived at the warehouse on a Friday, a man at the gatehouse outside refused any entrance and would not give any answers to questions. Quote, this is a secure facility. You're not even supposed to be standing there, he said. A former Chicago police superintendent and a more recently retired detective, both of whom have been inside Homan Square in the last few years, in a post-police capacity, said the police department did not operate out of the warehouse until the 1990s. But in detailing episodes involving their clients over the past several years, lawyers described mad scrambles that led to the closed door of Homan Square, a place most had never heard of previously. The facility was even unknown to Rob Warden, the founder of Northwestern University's Law School Center on Wrongful Convictions, until The Guardian informed him of the allegations of clients who vanished into inherently coercive police custody. Quote, they just disappear until they show up at a district for charging or are just released back onto the street, end quote, said Anthony Hill, a criminal defense attorney.
This just keeps getting worse.
Jacob Church learned about Homan Square the hard way on May 16, 2012. He and 11 others were taken there after police infiltrated their protests against the NATO summit. Church says the officers cuffed him to a bench for an estimated 17 hours, intermittently interrogating him without reading him his Miranda rights to remain silent. It would take another 3 hours and an unusual lawyer visit through a wire cage before he was finally charged with terrorism-related offenses at the nearby 11th District Station, where he was made to sign papers fingerprinted and photographed. In preparation for the NATO protest, Church, who is from Florida, had written a phone number for the National Lawyers Guild on his arm as a precautionary measure. Once taken to Homan Square, Church asked explicitly to call his lawyer and said he was denied. Quote, "Essentially, I wasn't allowed to make any contact with anybody," end quote, Church told The Guardian, in contradiction of a police guidance on permitting phone calls and legal counsel to arrestees. Church's left wrist was cuffed to a bar behind a bench in a windowless cinder block cell, with his ankles cuffed together. He remained in those restraints for over 17 hours. Quote, "I had essentially figured, all right, well, they disappeared us and we're probably never going to see the light of day," end quote, said Church. Though the raid attracted major media attention, a team of attorneys could not find Church through 12 hours of active searching, Sarah Gelsomino, Church's lawyer, recalled. No booking record existed. Only after she and others made a major stink with contacts in the offices of the Corporation Council and Mayor Rahm Emanuel did they even learn about Homan Square. They sent another attorney to the facility, where he ultimately gained entry and talked to Church through a floor-to-ceiling chain-link metal cage. Finally, hours later, police took Church and his two co-defendants to a nearby police station for booking. After serving 2.5 years in prison, Church is currently on parole after he and his co-defendants were found not guilty in 2014 of terrorism-related offenses, but guilty of lesser charges of possessing an incendiary device and the misdemeanor of, quote, mob action, end quote. The access that NATO 3 attorneys received to Homan Square was an exception to the rule, even if Jacob Church's experience there was not. Three attorneys interviewed by The Guardian report being personally turned away from Homan Square between 2009 and 2013 without being allowed access to their clients. Two more lawyers who hadn't been physically denied described it as a place where police withheld information about their clients' whereabouts. Church was the only person who had been detained at the facility who agreed to talk with The Guardian. Their lawyers say others fear police retaliation. One man in January of 2013 had his name changed in the Chicago Central booking database and then taken to Homan Square without a record of his transfer being kept. According to Eliza Solowiedge, of Chicago's first defense legal aid, she found out where he was after he was taken to the hospital with a head injury. Quote, "He said that the officer caused his head injuries in an interrogation room at Homan Square. I had been looking for him for 6 to 8 hours, and every department member I talked to said that they'd never heard of him. He sent me a phone pic of his head injuries because I had seen him in a police station right before he was transferred to Homan Square without any," end quote, said Solowiedge. Bartmus, another Chicago attorney, said that in September of 2013, she got a call from a mother worried that her 15-year-old son had been picked up by police before dawn. A sympathetic sergeant followed up with the mother to say her son was being questioned at Homan Square in connection to a shooting and would be released soon. When hours passed, Bartmus traveled to Homan Square only to be refused entry for nearly an hour. An officer told her, quote, "Well, you can't just stand here taking notes. This is a secure facility. There are undercover officers and you're making people very nervous," end quote, Bartmus recalled. Told to leave, she said she would return in an hour if the boy was not released. He was home and not charged after, quote, 12, maybe 13 hours in custody, end quote. On February 2nd, 2013, John Hubbard was taken to Homan Square. Hubbard never walked out. The Chicago Tribune reported that the 44-year-old was found unresponsive inside an interview room.
Oh my God.
And pronounced dead. After publication, Cook County Medical Examiner told The Guardian that the cause of death was determined to be a heroin intoxication. Homan Square is hardly concerned exclusively with terrorism. Several special units operating outside of it, including the anti-gang and anti-drug forces. If police, quote, want money, guns, drugs, end quote, or information on the flow of any of them into Chicago streets, quote, they bring them there and use it as a place of interrogation off the books, end quote, Hill said. A former Chicago detective and current private investigator, Bill Dorsch, said he had not heard of the police abuses described by Church and lawyers for other suspects who had been taken to Homan Square. He had been permitted access to the facility to visit one of its main features, an evidence locker for the department. Transferring detainees through police custody to deny them access to legal counsel would be a career-ender, said Dorsch. Quote, "To move just for the purpose of hiding them, I can't see that happening," end quote, he told The Guardian. You know what? That's probably enough for that part. We can skip a little bit ahead here because, look, at the end of the day, the Chicago Police Department has acknowledged this in response to the Guardian's article, which I was reading to you. The Chicago Police Department first denied any wrongdoing, but in 2015, as Chicago was experiencing activist pressures resulting from outrage over the Homan Square reporting and the murder of Laquan McDonald, separate thing, but anyways, the city under Mayor Rahm Emanuel announced a reparation deal for the 1970 survivors of torture and detention under former Chicago Police Commander John Burge. The deal included a $5.5 million fund for torture survivors, free college tuition for survivors and their families, a memorial and inclusion of the torture cases in 8th and 10th grade history courses in Chicago school districts. A coalition of Chicago activists, including Project NIA and We Charge Genocide, were major backers of this deal. So they did make some changes. From what I've read, people are not happy with the amount of changes that have taken place, and they are not sufficient enough to clearly show the CPD has learned from their lessons. And in fact, the guy, John Burge, he did serve some time in jail. He kept his pension until he died. So it wasn't bad enough that he had money taken away from him.
This is insane. I don't even want to know what to make of this one.
And whether or not this is the only one, or if it's just the one that got found.
It can't be. It seems like it's the one that got found.
And really, it's just they accidentally arrested somebody who had some money and a lawyer, as opposed to the poor black and brown people, as they talked about.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, we're never going to know how many people were coerced into confessing to something they didn't do because they were beaten so harshly at Homan Square, or how many people died there. We're just never going to know because it's a black site that had no records maintained. For everybody listening, we're adding this in posthumously, I guess. I think the episode's dead once we've kind of recorded it, right? Like, that's how it works?
Yeah.
I don't actually know. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
It's an article I forgot to add in here. This, in fact, has been condemned by the UN. This surprised the hell out of me. It's on the UN's website. It's United Nations Human Rights Office of the High Commissioner, posted on June 3rd, 2024. United States, UN experts urge action to address lives stolen by systemic racist police violence in Chicago. UN experts today called for further action to remedy racialized police violence and misconduct within Chicago's law enforcement and criminal justice system against people of African and Latino descent in the United States. Quote, Chicago has a long history of law enforcement officials reportedly using torture to extract confessions to serious crimes. These heinous, alleged human rights violations appear to a significant extent to be rooted in systemic racism and have disproportionately affected people of the African and Latin American descent, says the UN expert. The experts stress the devastating impact of these practices on individuals and communities. Quote, many people of African and Latin American descent, some of whom were children at the time, were reportedly arrested without reasonable cause and tortured to sign confessions to very serious crimes, including homicide. These confessions, as well as broader systemic racism and police misconduct in Chicago's criminal justice system, have reportedly resulted in many wrongful convictions and wrongful incarcerations of individuals, often for extremely long periods of time without adequate access to healthcare, including for older persons and survivors of torture. Lives have been stolen with a significant ripple effect within the community, end quote, they said. Chicago has taken steps to address the reported human rights violations, including a public apology and the establishment of the Torture Inquiry and Relief Commission to acknowledge and remedy and prevent police torture and misconduct. While welcoming these important initiatives, the experts expressed concern that efforts to address abuse have been piecemeal and far too slow in implementation. They expressed their concern that individuals affected remain incarcerated or unable to rebuild their lives due to systemic barriers that prevent their access to procedures to be established with innocence and access full redress and remedies. The experts also expressed concerns that reports indicate that such alleged human rights violations have taken place largely with impunity. Quote, the individuals implicated in these human rights violations have not been held accountable. A just society must address these past wrongs and put in place all measures to prevent recurrence, end quote, the experts said. The experts urge relevant federal, state, and local officials to take immediate and comprehensive action to fully address and remedy the situation in Chicago. The UN experts have been in contact with the government of the United States to address these allegations and clarify its obligations under international law. That's the end of the article. I found it so crazy that usually when you see condemnation from the United Nations. It's not against a first world country, excluding the whole debacle with Israel. We're just going to leave them out of this with that.
I don't know that I get my news from the United Nations website, but not only are these people, this seems like it's not a related thought, but it is. Not only are these people being not held accountable, but I mean, this isn't just news that is widely known. It is on the United Nations website, but I didn't know about it. I watched the news. I've never even heard of it until this Journey to the Fringe episode.
This could have been a Fringy mini this week. Like, literally, it happened in June, this article on the UN website.
Yeah, I would have taken it from a few years ago, too.
Yeah.
I have no standards.
But I just wanted to add that because it's so mind-boggling. Like, you don't think about the UN condemning things in North America, and yet here they are. Like, this is terrible and needs to be addressed.
I do. I also wonder what else are they condemning, but I don't know because I'll never visit their website. I don't even know what would bring me there in the first place, to be honest.
Me sending
even
you
though
a link,
I find this interesting.
Yes. Anyhow, back to the original episode.
I'm speechless. All of this. And you're right, it did just progressively get worse. Not that the first one was good. It didn't go good to worst. It just went worst to worst.
But yeah, these are systemic issues within law enforcement departments that show that there is something rotten with the entire situation that we have, I think. It's not just one-off individuals that have problems. It is systemic.
Yeah.
Any one of these you can point to and say that there are major issues. I know people are going to point at the particular cities they take place in. I'm going to tell you right now, it's not just these ones. You will find them anywhere. And hell, like I remember with the New York PD, they threatened the previous mayor with a doxing on his daughter. Just openly. That's how it worked. There's issues all over.
I mean, these are just three things. I'm sure there's a whole lot that we could be pulling up. I was not expecting there to be gangs operating within, I don't know what the technical term for it is, the police, generally.
Well, yeah, and you got to assume that's not the only place where something like that's taking place, even if it's not particularly named gangs. That process that they talk about of covering up for each other and having this rite of passage, which is violently attacking people.
No, the whole thing has been a crazy ride. As always, I appreciate you enlightening me to this.
Even if you don't want it, it's just how kind of it works. Anyhow.
Oh, I never want it.
Yeah. I have been Taylor. Here we're Chelsea. We are Journey to the Fringe. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Journey to the Fringe. If you have liked what you have listened to, please like, share, subscribe, or follow, depending on what venue you are listening to us through. Also, please, if possible, leave a 5-star review, as that really helps us in the algorithms. Should you wish to interact with us, please check us out on your social media of choice. I bet you we are there. And if you really want to communicate with us and give us ideas for new episodes or tell us that we're wrong and terrible, either way, please send us an email at journeytothefringe@gmail.com. For now, I'll see you in the next episode.